The Laura Murphy Show, episode 26.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Greetings, everyone, to another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. I am one of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as normal, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things going up there in Nashville?
Well, they're going pretty good, Bob. We had a really nice day today. Kind of sunny and not too hot. But, you know, it's interesting. I don't know. There's something in the air. I was at the dentist, as a matter of fact, and even while I was getting my teeth worked on, both the hygienist and then the doctor himself, they were just talking about all the crazy things that are going on in our world. And I mean, there's really a sense of apprehension. And I don't know if it's because we're coming up on the debates or, but you know, there is a lot of crazy things going on. So yeah, the day was beautiful in Nashville, but there's some strange things in the air.
Well, that's kind of disturbing. I really don't like people being apprehensive when they got their hands in my mouth. So I kind of want them to talk about puppy dogs and rainbows. Speaking of Nashville, I am going to be there, folks, later this month. We're broadcasting here in September 2016. And we want to draw your attention to a special event Carlos and I have planned for all of you avid listeners. It's going to be a live video streaming broadcast that we're going to do from Nashville. The date this is going to occur is Monday, September 26th, and it's going to occur right before the presidential debate. So that's the way you're gonna know, just to anchor that in your memory here, to know when it's going to happen. So it's the same day as that first presidential debate. To get the access link, because you're going to need a special link to be able to go to the video where this is going to be streaming, you're just going to go to our website. So laramurphy.com, and again, that's LARA-MURPHY.com. You'll see this huge banner ad on the front page there. Just that'll give you the ability to register. So we'll be able to send you a special email link to take you to the place to see the video. So what are we going to talk about in this video broadcast? We're going to just summarize the state of the economy, tell you why we think things are dire. The title is How to Weather the Coming Financial Storms. We're going to show you the various reasons that we think the economy is very fragile right now. But then more important, we're not just going to leave you hanging. We're going to give you specific strategies that you can implement immediately to not completely isolate yourself, but to do as much as is humanly possible to sort of secede from this crumbling system. Carlos, do you want to say anything else about the live video broadcast?
No, other than I'm really looking forward to it. I think this is something that we have put a great deal of thought into, and just the opportunity to be able to talk to folks and provide them, you know, with some strategies that they can implement for their own household and their businesses. I think it'd be a good thing for everybody.
So once again, this is going to be Monday, September 26th. The actual time is going to be from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern time. And again, to help you remember, that wraps up an hour before the first presidential debate is scheduled to occur. So again, it's How to Weather the Coming Financial Storms. For more details, to see exactly what we're planning on covering, just go to laramurphy.com. And again, you'll get the ability once you go there to register and make sure you get the email link that gives you the access to the special video. So what are we going to talk about now in episode 26 of the Laura Murphy Show? I think what we need to do is just summarize some of the highlights from the August LMR that came out. The LMR is the Laura Murphy Report. Again, if you are a listener to the podcast, you like what we're doing here, we strongly encourage you to go check out the archives of the Laura Murphy Report that we have available at the website, and you may want to become a subscriber. Today, we're just going to hit some of the key points of our recent articles in the LMR. Of course, for full details, you're going to want to become a subscriber and see what we did here. But this stuff is really very hot. Carlos is going to start it off. He, you may remember previously, was talking about the problem with Europe's banks, and he did some more digging. And, you know, people say, Bob, why you latch up with this guy, Carlos Lara? Well, among other reasons, he's a financial investigative journalist. All right. He goes and digs stuff up that, I'm not kidding you folks, will pop up on Zero Hedge 6 months later. All right. So the big thing was he went and started reading the Dodd-Frank Act. I mean, what the heck? Even the congressman didn't do that. I don't know what he was thinking. And he found all sorts of stuff about bail-ins back in the day. Now he's been looking at the Italy's financial system, and they did some testing, and Carlos found some disturbing results. So Carlos, why don't you tell our listeners the takeaway from what you found in this last research effort you went into?
Well, once again, I think as was reported in the previous month of the LMR issue, that Italy's banking crisis is obviously still top priority over in the Eurozone area. There's a lot of things going on in the United States as well, and I may talk a little bit about that too. But when we talk about having some kind of a major market correction that may occur here, it could happen in Europe. That could be the triggering point, is what I'm seeing. Or it could happen here. But what we're seeing in Italy specifically now, I don't know if you thought about this or not, but Italy is one of the world's top 10 economies. So it ranks way up there as far as one of the major economies of the world. And yet its banks, its banking system has one foot in the grave. And so we've got all these policymakers out there trying to make some decisions on whether the going back to the taxpayer bailouts is the only remedy, you know, to solve this this situation. Now, of course, the European Central Bank now, just like we do here in the United States, has specific rules against the bailouts, using taxpayer money to save these too big to fail operations. But the Italian banks are in such bad shape that there's talk that they may have to revert back to that. Now, what we're seeing here is that this whole thing could very easily spiral out of control all throughout Europe. And then, of course, after Britain did this vote to leave the Union, well, that basically, you know, seal the coffin for these banks, because even the largest bank in Italy, with something like 892 billion euros in assets, which is pretty substantial size, it plunged 60% in just this year. So the situation is not good, and we're talking about a whole.
Can I stop you? When you say it plunged 60%, you're saying what, the share price?
Yeah, the share price of the bank. So, and it's just not that bank. It's all of them are in real dire straits right now. But the Eurozone, not just in Italy, the whole Eurozone has several weak banks that we would consider here in the United States as SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions that are really too big, big. And of course, one of the biggest ones is Deutsche Bank. And that's a big bank. If it were to collapse, well, it would really cause some serious economic problems in Europe, and would cause them for other parts of the world as well, because that particular bank is, well, see, it's five times larger than Lehman Brothers. That's how big that bank is.
It's funny. I was actually just Googling that because I knew it was bigger, and I was trying to get my factoid to chime in and add something in the conversation, but I see you beat me to the punch. So I have nothing to add. Continue.
Well, I'm just saying that's, you know, we're starting to see that whole situation down there is not good. Now, the immediate problem, of course, is these banks in Italy have got an enormous amount of bad debts on the books. And we're talking something like 400 billion euros. And when we start to ask, well, how did these loans get in such bad shape? How did we get there? We have to walk back to the 2008 financial crisis and remember that countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, Spain, Ireland, you know, and other countries like that, they were all bailed out with taxpayer funds. These banks were bailed out with taxpayer funds. Well, Italy, for some strange reason, didn't need, you know, to capitalize its banks during that period of time. So what Italy did instead, it was waiting for an economic recovery, you know, and it's a recovery that really never happened. And so as the economy has trudged along since the 2008 crisis, you know, just in a continual slump, these loan defaults began to mount. And then all kinds of bad rumors about the weaknesses in the bank started to intensify. And then, here recently, we had Brexit. And so that's when it really all hit the fan. So what we got now is a situation where everybody's trying to decide, how are we going to clean up this mess? You know, how are we going to do it? Now, again, under the European Central Bank rules, which are now bail-in rules, these too big to fail financial institutions, it requires the shareholders and the creditors, you know, to foot the bill instead of going to the taxpayers. Now, the problem is that right now you have an enormous amount of middle-class individuals who have placed their life savings into these Italian bank bonds. And for this very reason, the whole country is just, you know, worried sick of what could happen here if this whole banking situation is not handled with care. So that's the kind of problem we have. And the prime minister down there in Italy, this fellow by the name of Matteo Renzi, you know, he thinks that if they do a bail-in, I mean, that for sure is going to send the country into an economic panic and could spark all kinds of bank runs. So a bail-in, he thinks it would worsen the situation. And so this is the agenda, the message that he fully intended to take to the ECB and to Angela Merkel last month. And what he was hoping to do was to get them to bend the rules and get away from this bail-in idea. And the surprising thing was that when all of shouting and the arguing was said and done, the results coming from what the ECB actually did, was that it not only bent the rules, but it winds up, you know, actually reversing some of the bigger rules that they had in place. Like, for example, one of them was the Pillar 2 requirement, and this is the amount of capital ratio that these banks are supposed to have, all of which they needed to have in place when they did the stress test here recently. Well, what the ECB is now saying that it's going to allow these banks to, you know, more or less determine what their own capital needs are. And they're saying the banks, instead of the ECB, can now report to the public exactly what their loan quality is and the leverage that they have. So not only is it more or less loosening the reins on this on these stress tests and the rules that they once had in place, it's even going to limit its supervisors from going in and demanding burden of proof from these banks as to their capitalization. So what everybody's realizing is that the ECB is relieving all of these weak banks throughout the Eurozone from billions of dollars of capital requirements. And so in essence, they've done that in one astonishing reversal.
Let me stop you, Carlos, and paraphrase what I think you're saying just to make sure our listeners are getting it. So big picture, after the financial crisis, all the policymakers are scratching their heads and saying, wow, we can't let that happen again. So from now on, folks, don't worry. We learned our lesson, and we're going to put in some really tight capital tighter capital requirements on the banks so that, you know, to make sure they don't get in trouble again, they don't get caught with their pants down. Come to find out right now, if they really stringently applied those tighter rules that are in place, so many of Italy's banks would fail. That would freak the public out, and then something would have to be done, either a bail-in or a bail-out. And the bailout they don't want to do because that would be politically unacceptable to the, you know, general public. But the bail-ins also are unacceptable to the major creditors and so forth, the people who have their life savings in the banks. And so what they decided to do was to say, let's actually not enforce these rules and let these banks get away with what, according to our own revised standards, is incredibly reckless. Is that about right?
That is right. And, you know, they were all working up to the stress test. Well, they did the stress test, but they didn't reveal the outcome of the stress test. Almost half of all the banks that they tested, they chose not to reveal the findings. It's almost like a cover-up.
Wait a second. You're telling me who does these? Like the government or the ECB, some kind of financial commission?
That's correct.
So they conduct these stress tests of the bank to reassure the public that they're not asleep at the wheel, and then they didn't divulge the outcome of these tests for half the banks?
That's right. They covered it up. And Bob, what I think the reason is because this the situation was bad, but then this Brexit thing made it even worse. You see what I'm saying? And so they'd already determined they were going to have these stress tests all along, but Brexit came in the middle of all that and basically has really, you know, created a paralyzed economy down there. And to reveal just how bad off these banks are could, in and of itself, send a panic throughout the whole place. So they chose not to reveal the findings of these stress tests. It's a really incredible.
Well, it reminds me, I won't use the guy's name, but I knew somebody who was intimately connected with the American banking sector. And he told, so this is anecdotal, but I believe him, that back after the financial crisis struck, there was a period there where there were many U.S. commercial banks that were not in good shape, and that if FDIC had applied its full standards to them, it would have had to shut down, you know, so many that it would have terrified the public. And so that the FDIC was actually slow walking the process of going in and looking at banks and shutting them down and, you know, doing the orderly liquidation, blah, 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 that it goes through in situations like that, because he knew, or because the FDIC officials just knew, this is, you know, we can't handle this kind of caseload. So it sounds like a similar thing here, where they look at the situation and realize, if we actually told the public exactly how bad these Italian banks were, that would just be a situation we don't want to deal with, so let's just not tell them.
That's exactly it. And so when you start putting all these pieces together, the fact that they've had these weak banks, you know, that are just basically hanging on, then you have this Brexit situation, which was a major event. And you add the negative interest rates that's going on down there on top of that, which are just absolutely crazy. You know, you've got a real problem down there. Now, I don't know about you, Bob, but the idea of having negative interest rates, I mean, that to me from the beginning sounded like an absolutely ridiculous strategy to use. But it's clear now that they are distorting the financial markets. And there's a lot of critics now that believe that this unorthodox scheme that the feds, the central bankers have put in place here, is really backfiring now. It's putting an awful lot of pressure on these banks. They're already having problems as it is with their weakness, but to put this extra pressure on them with these negative rates is killing the whole situation, you see. Now, it's true that the European Central Bank was charging their banks, you know, to hold money on deposit. And clearly, the chairman of the European Central Bank, this fellow named Draghi, you know, he made it very clear that this negative interest rates was for the banks only.
You mean as opposed to the general public who puts their money on deposit?
That's right. It's for the banks only. Now he said, if you bankers decide to pass it on to the public, I mean, that's your doing. That's not me doing it. Okay. But the problem is that these banks, they're going to wind up passing it on to the public. And in fact, you know, some of them have already started. They're in the Eurozone. And so that presents a whole different problem because it drives cash out of the banks. The people will start withdrawing their cash out of the banks and putting them into safes or under their mattresses. And even the whole thing, they start passing it over to the depositors. I mean, it could cause a bank run in and of itself. So this negative interest rate, it's just causing some major upheavals down there on top of everything else that's going on.
Well, and all this dovetails. I mean, that's why you got guys like Ken Rogoff of Harvard now coming out with a book explaining why we should get rid of cash, you know, or just use small denominations for little petty purchases, but the horrors of having large amounts of cash in circulation. So this stuff is all coming together to give us negative interest rates and absolute centralized control of all financial transactions. But I'm sure once the experts get control of everything, they'll be able to fix it finally. Well, that was pretty terrifying what you just pointed out here, Carlos. So let me make sure Americans don't say, well, I'm glad I don't live in Europe and we're safe over here. Not so fast, folks. Let me just give you a few of the highlights. So my article from the August LMR was on the federal debt because this thing has been ratcheting up. And I think Americans have just been distracted with Trump and Hillary's health and ISIS and all this other stuff. And lo and behold, the federal debt really has just been growing by leaps and bounds. Let me just throw a few numbers at you and also just tell you how to distinguish them, because there's lots of different figures people throw around when talking about the federal debt. So the big picture number, if you go to like the Treasury and say, what's the outstanding total public debt? That figure right now is roughly $19.5 trillion. And so when they're talking about like the debt ceiling, that's roughly what this number means, that's the amount of Treasury securities, you know, T-bonds, T-bills, T-notes, things like that, pieces of paper that are legal obligations from the U.S. Treasury saying the owner of this thing is entitled to a certain payment of dollars from Uncle Sam on this date. So the total amount of those things, the value is about $19.5 trillion right now. Now, one major way of breaking that down is they'll say it's $14.1 trillion is so-called debt held by the public, while the other $5.4 trillion is what's called intra-governmental holdings. So that stuff is stuff like the so-called Social Security Trust Fund. So it's like the federal government itself owns $5.4 trillion of these Treasury securities. All right, so what happens there, just to show you the mechanism. For many years in the 80s and 90s, Social Security was running a surplus, right? So they were taking in more money from payroll taxes, you know, workers who were having Social Security taken out of their paychecks, than the Social Security Administration was sending in checks to beneficiaries. So when that would happen, when the Social Security Administration would take in more cash than it had to, you know, pay out the door, what they do with it? They would buy treasuries. And so what, if you think about it, what was happening is the federal government itself was spending that surplus and then telling the Social Security Administration, don't worry, we're good for it. So as of right now, $5.4 trillion of this total Treasury debt is in the form of what's called intra-governmental holdings. So that's why some people say, that's kind of a shell game. It's like one part of the government owns the other part. So the figure, when we say things like debt to GDP ratios and so on, we're comparing them among countries, usually they'll pick what's called debt held by the public, which is, quote, only $14.1 trillion. All right, so there's that number for you. Let me mention, though, that really is understating the problem. Now, for one thing, if you compare that to the, quote, income of the federal government, like to try to get an idea of what's the debt to income ratio, And you say, okay, well, if you look at like tax receipts, like that's kind of like the income, even though it's not voluntarily earned. But you get what I'm saying, that of the total revenues the government takes in, it's got this debt owed to outsiders, people that are not the U.S. federal government, of $14.1 trillion. What's that ratio look like? It's about 400%. All right, so, and it's not like this is a collateralized debt the way like you could have a mortgage or something. You could just sell the house if you can't afford to service it. I mean, this is money they owe people who own treasuries that's just based off of future incoming tax revenue. All right, so that's pretty alarming. But let me just throw a few more numbers. I don't want to overwhelm you guys, but the real big numbers you might have heard when you hear just ridiculous figures about how deeply in debt is the U.S. government right now, it refers to what's called unfunded liabilities. And this is about Social Security, but more specifically Medicare. And so here, the reason this is different, so right now, the federal government is on the hook in terms of the promises it has made to workers saying, hey, you know, we've been pulling money out of your paycheck all these years in the form of payroll taxes. And, you know, that's not federal income tax. This is a separate thing, a separate line item that's ostensibly being used to fund your retirement, you know, your Social Security and then your Medicare that you're going to get, you know, once you're retired. And so and they have a benefit formula for that. So the point is, if you count that, So those liabilities were not in the figure I just mentioned, the $14.1 trillion. The $14.1 trillion is just people who own literal treasury securities, like pieces of paper, you know, issued by the Uncle Sam when they borrowed money explicitly, whereas workers who think, okay, once I hit 63 or whatever and I retire and I'm just going to start pulling, that's money they think they are owed by Uncle Sam, but that's not showing up in the official debt statistics. So when you actuarially go through and run those numbers and make some, you know, normal assumptions the way any actuaries would if they were looking like at a pension plan for a private company or what have you, there, the figures they come up with, just to give you an example, when Doug McGuff and I did our Primal Prescription book, we found that as of 2009, before the Affordable Care Act went through, and I picked that because the Affordable Care Act kind of monkeyed with all the long-term projections. But as of 2009, just to give you a reference point, the government's own actuaries, or you know, Social Security trustees, those people that are in charge of reporting this stuff, from their own official reports, so you know this is not overstated. If anything, they're doing what they can to keep the number low. They used a 75-year time horizon and projected that there was a $45.8 trillion present value shortfall. So, you know, what does that mean? It's saying, they were saying over the next 75 years, we are going to have a shortfall, that eventually we're going to be taking in less in payroll contributions than we owe to people using the existing benefit formula. And that shortfall is going to be so big that right now, today, we would need $45.8 trillion to set aside to start earning interest so that over the next 75 years we could be whole and pay everybody what they think they're going to get. All right, so it's keep in mind, this is like including all the future taxes they're going to impose on people pulling stuff out of their paycheck. This is just a shortfall, and again, it's a present value figure. The total dollar amount over the 75 years is way bigger than $45.8 trillion. Just saying we would need $45.8 trillion right now and have to invest it to start rolling over so that it could eventually cover these gaps. All right, so I will stop there. Carlos, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that.
Well, other than I'm getting shell-shocked just listening to you talk. I've given these numbers a pass through several times before, Bob, and it's just incredible. You know, the amount of debt that has stacked up on the United States. And, you know, it doesn't have any easy answers that I can see. It's too big to fail for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, you raise a good point. So, you know, what does that mean? What it means, of course, is that they're going to eventually increase the quote contributions on payroll taxes, so your workers are going to have more taken out of their paychecks, and they're going to cut the benefits either by explicitly reducing the amount you get per year and also probably pushing back the quote retirement age, right? The age at which you can start drawing benefits. I mean, that's the only, I mean, it's got to be a combination of those things, because it's clearly not that they're just going to somehow out of general revenue come up with the money to fund that. So there's all those things. Another thing too, just to keep in mind, folks, the reason we haven't really felt the pain of how much the debt has mushroomed in the last few years. Look, there were 3 years in a row, three consecutive years under the Obama administration, where the budget deficit, right? So just the annual gap between revenues and spending was more than $1 trillion. Right? So that's just astonishing when you think about that, that they were borrowing $1 trillion 3 years in a row. The reason we haven't really felt the pain from that, the chickens haven't come home to roost from that, is because interest rates have been so low. Okay, so in other words, as the federal debt itself has mushroomed, the cost of servicing a given level of debt has plummeted because treasury yields have dropped so much. So that has masked the servicing cost. But if and when interest rates go back up towards more normal levels, then it's going to be pretty obvious the consequences, just the immediate consequences of carrying such a larger federal debt, that you know all the incoming tax receipts, a bigger and bigger portion is going to have to be used just to keep from defaulting on the outstanding debt. So they're painting themselves into a corner, and the longer this persists, that's just going to make it more painful, which is why, you know, Carlos and I keep reiterating what you want to do now is rearrange your portfolio so that you can insulate yourself as much as possible from these coming financial storms, which are baked into the cake. Obviously, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know exactly when it's going to happen. We do have some thoughts on that. And what we can do is just encourage you not only to keep listening to this podcast, go to the website, but also make sure you sign up and register for this live broadcast, this video streaming broadcast we're going to do. Again, it's going to be Monday, September 26th. But you don't need to wait till then. Right now, go ahead and go to the website and sign up so that you can get the notification and get the link. Again, the website is laramurphy.com. Any parting words for our shell-shocked listeners at this point, Carlos?
Well, at this time, you know, just in the course of events, even the element of surprise is really all that is required, you know, to trigger the next catastrophic event. I mean, this is how fragile and how explosive everything has gotten. That just some startling event of doesn't even have to be big, you know, can really rock the markets. So it's sort of a scary thing that things have come together to this point, but that's where we are, and that's one of the reasons why we're so anxious to have this live streaming video to help as many families and as many businesses as we can to protect themselves, you know, from the storms that are definitely on their way.
Well, with those cheery words, folks, we will wrap it up here. So make sure you go to the website, laramurphy.com. That's LARA-Murphy.com. You'll see the information for how you register for the event. Share this podcast with others and stay safe. We will see you next time. Thanks, everybody.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LaraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.